Good morning, everybody. Broadcasting live again from the beautiful penthouse suite on the top floor of the GBC office complex, just located diagonally across from that exquisite little French restaurant, Le Wawa. Still open, even in these difficult times, for you to indulge your culinary tastes. So here we are, glad to be with you once again. And today we're picking up on the series we've been working on for a number of months now, that we've entitled The God Who Is Here. And we've come to a place where we're going to focus on some of the challenges of living with this God, challenges to understanding what he's like. And we're going to be focusing on the book of Job. Certainly, I'm finding one of the most difficult books in the whole of the biblical canon in terms of understanding who God is and what's going on in the book. So glad to have you along. As Wes said, we're going to take questions, but we're going to give ourselves a little bit more time on that. So you can submit in the chat session if you've got questions during the sermon, but you may well find that your questions come up later as you reflect on what we've talked about. And so you can send me questions anytime during the week. My church email here, Dave D at Grace Bible Satterton.org. And I'll be glad to talk with you about that. Again, it gives a little time, and if we get a lot of questions, we won't be able to handle them all, but we'll try to work some of that in along the way. And it's helpful to me just to know what you're thinking about, because it gives me fresh ideas as well. I've suggested that you may want to read the book of Job, or if not the whole book, read along with us as we go. I had proposed that you read chapters 1 and 2 for this week. And for next week, I'd say read chapter 2 and chapter 3. So let's get started then as we look at the blameless man. Reading the first chapter of the book of Job. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, very well, then. Everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself, do not lay a finger. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, your sons and your daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell on the ground in worship and said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. The story of the blameless man, twice in this chapter, that is the description of Job. So let's start thinking then about this man and his life and his relationship with God. To do that, we have to start first with this question. What is wisdom? We ask that question because Job is one of a number of books in the Old Testament which are put in this category called wisdom literature. This would be the book of Proverbs, the book of Ecclesiastes, certain of the Psalms, and then clearly the book of Job falls into this category. Wisdom, what do we mean by that? Or what does the Bible mean when it talks about wisdom? Here's our wise old owl. What does it mean from the standpoint of the Bible to be wise? And a definition that we've used from time to time before is this definition. Wisdom means living God's way in God's world. Wisdom is a way of life. It's a pattern that guides our steps. It guides our decisions, our actions, our thinking. It's like a path that leads you through the forest of life where there's all kinds of twists and turns and there's unknowns, but the path leads you through. Jesus talked about a path, didn't he? He said there is a narrow path that leads to life. And this is the path of wisdom, especially in the Old Testament, living God's way in God's world. Here's a young owl. He's hoping to become a wise old owl. How do you do that? Well, you become a wise old owl by early on making the decision that that's what you want to be. You're going to learn this path. And when's the best time to start? Well, the best time to start is probably yesterday, but certainly today, whether you are 30 years old or whether you're 13 or even younger, the best time to start learning to be wise is a young age, because it is a lifetime challenge to learn how to live God's way in God's world. Now, one of the fundamental problems that the world brings to us and that challenges our living wisely is this question, which is very much the question of the book of Job. And that is, how do we confront suffering? How do we think about it? And how do we respond to it in our lives? Important question, because we are all going to face suffering all through our lives. It's going to come to us sometimes because of our own decisions. We make poor decisions and we suffer the consequences. We're going to suffer because of things that other people do to us. And we're going to suffer then too, because the world is a difficult place. And this is our common lot. It's such an important part of living that we shouldn't be surprised that God's wisdom has much to teach us in the area. Especially difficult is this question: how do we process innocent suffering? Granted, many times when we suffer, it's because of stuff we've done, we've brought on ourselves, but there is clearly a whole category of suffering for which we're not to blame. And sometimes we don't know, as in Job's case, why it's happening to us, but we're sure that it's not something that we've brought upon ourselves. That is the challenge that the book of Job is going to wrestle with. So let's think about Job. This story starts out telling us that Job is the best wise man of the East. There's nobody like him. Verse 3 says he was the greatest man among all the people of the East. We're not sure just where he lived. We're told he lived in the land of Uz, and the scholars aren't sure where that is. He does live to the east, which in biblical perspective, you orient yourself to the land of Palestine. And the east means east of the Jordan River, which runs north to south, pretty much right through the center of the land. So east is across the Jordan and in the direction of the desert. Even in this story where people come in and steal from Job and kill his servants, they come from the desert. So this is where Job is from, but he is a good man. We're told twice he was blameless and upright. He feared God and he shunned evil. That he feared God and shunned evil is actually the scripture's definition of what it means to be wise. Proverbs tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Fear being there, awe, respect, reverence toward God. That is the beginning of wisdom. And Job had this. He feared God. And the consequence was that he shunned evil. He was, on the whole, blameless and upright. The word blameless has the idea of being complete, you look at Job from all different directions, and there is nothing lacking. He is just a good man. He cares for his family. He cares for the poor. His thought life is good. He relates in healthy ways to others. He loves God. He keeps God's commandments. He's upright, it says. This is Job. And God himself says to the Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is the best wise man. And so we're following the life of the best wise man, the greatest man of the East, as he falls into an abyss of suffering. And we're going to try to think with him about what is happening and sense his pain, because to some extent, fortunately for us, usually much less, but to some extent, we all can get in touch with this idea of innocent suffering. Now, here's part of what makes the suffering worse for Job. This devastating personal loss of his possessions, even more, his children, and later it's going to be his own health. But devastating personal loss, and Job doesn't know why it's happening. Here's part of the mystery of this book and the challenge of it. The dialogue, what we're going to call the wager between the devil and the Lord, is something that Job doesn't know about at all. Even at the end of the book, he doesn't know about it. And so he has to walk this difficult way of wisdom without an awareness of how this suffering has come upon him. You and I will sometimes face a similar thing as we encounter suffering in our lives. We won't know why, and that makes it more difficult to walk the way of wisdom, because we do so in ignorance. How do we connect with this story? Well, I've already suggested it's because we know about innocent suffering in our lives and in the lives of other people. Less than 20 years ago, we watched with horror as the Twin Towers at the Trade Center in New York City collapsed as the result of a terrorist attack. Thousands of innocent people died in those attacks. Perhaps you knew someone who was in that devastating experience, or maybe you knew someone who had family members or close friends that were connected with that. Well, that's one graphic example of innocent suffering. But that gets multiplied across the world in tsunamis and hurricanes that take large numbers of lives, in refugee camps where people are struggling just to survive through no fault of their own, but because larger international circumstances have driven them from their homes. Lots of suffering. And certainly a large portion of suffering is that of innocent victims. How do we walk the way of wisdom in the world, thinking about that and at times experiencing it directly ourselves? That's the question that Job raises for us, and we need to be thinking and experiencing that with him. Well, let's talk a little bit about this wager then that is in the background of Job's experience. the very idea that God would enter into a wager can seem strange and even a bit off-putting to us. It was maybe a month ago, I was speaking with Janice Freytag, and we were talking about starting this series on Job, and she said, you know, I have some problems right in the first chapter. I have some problems with God doing something like this, making a wager with the devil. How are we to understand that or to process it? And certainly there is a challenge here. I'm not sure that I've got clear answers to that. So let's talk about it a little bit anyway. Let's talk about this first character in the wager. He's called the Satan. Later in the Bibles, the term Satan almost becomes a personal name, and that's the way we tend to use it. There is this being called the devil, and he has a name. His name is Satan. But in the Old Testament, it's not a name, it's a title. And that's why the Hebrew language always has the definite article. It's the Satan. And the meaning of Satan there is the adversary. Or as the Greek translation of the Old Testament names him, it uses the word diabolos, the accuser, the one who attacks with words. So the Satan is the adversary here, the adversary of God, but especially the adversary of Job himself. And the Satan is a cynical character. You understand cynicism, right? Cynicism is that suspicious attitude that that questions other people's motivation, that assumes the worst about people. And this is the Satan. This is his function in the story. He's cynical. God says, Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like Job. He's blameless and upright. He fears me and he turns away from evil. And Satan says, really? There's nobody that can quite do cynicism like John Cleese, I think, for you Monty Python fans. Really, says the Satan? Job is really the best guy around? I don't think so. In fact, the reality is that Job is a hypocrite. Job wears a mask. That's what hypocrites do. They appear to be one thing on the outside, but underneath, they are something different. And this is the accusation that the cynical Satan brings against Job. God, you are being naive about Job. He is not the man you think he is. He appears to be because you take such good care of him. You have put a hedge about him so that nobody can hurt him. You have blessed him with riches, wealth, with a big family. Of course, Job is going to pretend that he loves you. But in fact, if you would take down the hedge, then you'd see what Job is really like. To which God responds. Well, before I note that, I just wanted to bring in this Revelation 12. Here we go to the end of the Bible, and think about this for a moment. John the Apostle says, I heard a loud voice in heaven say, now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down. This is a powerful verse because it suggests that what the Satan was doing in talking to God about Job is something that he continues to do. Right through the history of God's people. Here we are with John's vision of the end, and the Satan, the one he calls the accuser of our brothers and sisters, he's still doing it. He's still pointing the finger at them. He's still saying about you and about me, you know, God, the reality is these people are fake. You bless them. If you were not blessing them, they wouldn't be interested in you at all. They wouldn't be concerned to obey or show you reverence. That's the accusation that comes not only against Job, but it comes against you and me. And I guess at this point, it's not a bad thing for us to say, is there any ground for the Satan to accuse me in that way, to accuse you in that way? A part of what we have to wrestle with as we think about Job and its practical application is, where is our life with God? Do we serve God? Do we fear God? Do we love God? And for what reasons do we love, fear, and serve him? Is it for what he can give us or what he does give us? That's the Satan's accusation. Against Job, for sure, and I suspect that's the accusation that comes against me. And as I think about that, it makes me uncomfortable because I wonder if the test was applied. Maybe nothing nearly as hard as what Job experienced, but if the test were applied to me, what would the answer be? Would my response ultimately suggest that I am in my relationship with God for what I can get out of it personally? Or is there something more there? Is there actually a concern, an interest, a desire on my part to know God himself and not just to experience the blessings that he might give me? That's an important question. And God sees it as an important question. And I suppose that's part of the reason he takes up the wager here. God bets on Job. So let's think about this. We're just going to get a start on it today because this is one of the themes that runs through the whole of this challenging book. Let's talk about the God of the wager, the God who makes a wager on Job. What is he like? Even in this particular situation, why would he do this? What is his character? And I like this picture because the image is one in which the face is shadowed. We're not sure just what's under the visor there, are we? There is a mystery about this figure. And let's acknowledge it right up front, because the book of Job will push this for us pretty hard right through to the end. that the God who wagers on Job is a God whose ways are not our ways, whose thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are higher than ours. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. And there will then always be a side of mystery about his character. Now, that doesn't mean we don't know anything about God. God has revealed much concerning himself, but there are elements that we do not know. And I would say probably ultimately cannot know, because God is a God who is not only with us, but he's also transcendent. And there is a mystery about his character. This God who wagers on Job. Now, I do not want to pretend that I can explain that. I've been thinking about that for weeks, ever since Janice and I talked about it. There is one thing that stands out to me, even in this chapter, though. And that is that this mysterious God bets on Job. That is, he has an assumption about Job that Job is going to make it through, that this suffering will not defeat Job, although it's going to be incredibly difficult for him. In that sense, God shows himself right at the beginning to be for Job. He's betting on Job's success because he knows who Job is. And that in itself is such a powerful thing. We've said at various times in our study of the Old Testament that when you read the Old Testament, you always need to read it as a story that is going somewhere. You may remember we've tried to emphasize that. And so as we read Job, we want to read this as a story that is going somewhere as well. And ultimately, where all of the Old Testament stories take us is to the New Testament and to what God has done and is doing in Jesus Christ. And so that's where I want us to finish up thinking today. I actually want to look at two of the verses that Bruce and Linda read for us as we did our call to worship earlier this morning. It's the verses from Romans 8, 31 and 32. Paul has been discussing in this section in Romans the salvation that God has provided through the death and resurrection of Jesus. And as he sums it up, he asks this rhetorical question: what shall we say to these things? And here is his response. If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? If God is for us. Now, Job is in a difficult situation because he doesn't know what has happened to him or why it's happened. He doesn't understand that God is for him in all of that experience. But what he does is he holds on to God through all of his struggles, through all of this long book. Job holds on to God. He has a certain conviction about God. Now, that is something that we need to learn from. We are in a better place than Job because we are on the down history side of the cross. And Paul tells us that there is nothing that God has ever done or could ever do that would reveal more clearly to us this truth that God is for us Job doesn't have that benefit. We do. And so as we engage suffering, even innocent suffering, our own perhaps, and we engage it with all sorts of questions, God, why should this happen to me? Or why should it happen to my friend? How could you allow this? We acknowledge that there's mystery in this. Many times, like Job, we are not told why things happen the way we do, and that is troubling. And it raises questions for us. What is God like? How could he permit this? But here's where the story runs to, friends. For all of us, this is where the biblical story wants to take us. It wants to take us to that cross where Jesus died, where he died according to God's will, because God is for us. God is on our side in the midst of every circumstance and every difficulty. This is Paul's conclusion. Paul, of course, was not a stranger to innocent suffering. He had much of it in his life. You can read that in the book of 2 Corinthians. But Paul says, if God is for us, who can be against us? We know this because God did not spare his own son. And with the son, he will ultimately graciously give us all things. Well, I need to close this off here, friends. I'm not seeing my controls. So, let me encourage you to read further along in Job. Think about these questions. Send questions or comments to me as you have them. And let's grow together, because suffering is something that is part of all of our experience. But God is good. We trust him. He's the one who spared not his own son. Let me pray for you. Pray God's blessing upon you for this week. Now may the God of peace, who brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus, that great shepherd of the sheep, make you perfect in every good work to do his will, working in you that which is well-pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen. May God's peace be with you. Until next week, bye.